Hello, and welcome to How to Make a Memory, the show that explores the items we make for one another and how they impact our relationships. My name is Jen Tierney, and since Easter is just around the corner, I thought I would ask my mom to join me to talk about one of my family's favorite traditions. Every year, we make pizzagine, also known as pizza chiena, pizza rustica, Italian Easter pie, or Italian ham pie. There are a dizzying number of variations on this recipe, and I may be biased, but I think my family's is the best. If you're familiar with this pie, get ready for a mouth-watering trip down memory lane. And if this is your very first time hearing about pizzagine, prepare yourself for a regional delicacy of epic proportions. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Jen.
You're here for other reasons, but because you are here, I thought I'd take an opportunity to interview you for my show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Of course. So for everyone who is unfamiliar with the tradition that is pizzagine, mm-hmm. or pizza chiena, if you're from Italy, can you describe what this magical pie is?
It is magical. It truly is. Imagine a quiche, but 10 times more dense.
And rich.
And rich.
Super rich.
It involves a number of different cheeses and meats, some of which are prepared in advance, others that are not. Mm-hmm. But it started out as a peasant dish. Mm-hmm. In Italy, centuries ago, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And the version that I know of is obviously the one that my mother's family brought with them from Italy. Mm-hmm. And that would have been at the turn of the 19th into 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there had been a recipe formally written down early on. But at some point or other in the maybe 1940 or beyond, mm-hmm. somebody began to create the recipe. It includes a number of different meats, as I said, soprassod, which is a very hard sausage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a salami. Almost.
Like a salami, yeah. Excuse me, a salami. Boiled ham, Krakow's ham, pork tenderloin, uh-huh. Fryrich is the brand name we always use. And then later, Dad and I incorporated prosciutto, which we, to my knowledge, my mother, your grandmother, had not included in her recipe. Mm. In addition to all those wonderful meats, mm-hmm. Romano cheese, mm-hmm. Ricotta cheese, mm-hmm. I think shredded mozzarella, mm-hmm. and then...
And provolone, right?
And provolone, mm-hmm. excuse me. Oh, very good.
I got a good memory, let me tell you.
And... Eggs.
So many eggs.
So many eggs.
Like a worrying amount of eggs. People with high cholesterol need to steer clear of this pie.
Yes. Well, thank goodness it's only made once a year.
Yeah, it's true.
So there are uncooked eggs, and then there are boiled eggs, mm-hmm. that are
diced
and sliced and all of that with a handy-dandy egg slicer.
Yep.
Most of the... preparation of the meats, mm-hmm. is done in advance.
Yep.
And I have to backtrack a little bit. This is always done during Holy Week, the few, mm-hmm. days before Easter.
Yes.
And normally the process of cutting all the meats starts on Tuesday or Wednesday, mm-hmm. night. Your grandfather, Poppy, used to be very, very meticulous about the size of,
yes.
pieces of meat.
Yep.
Slice and dice, and it had to be a certain size.
Yeah.
And he would go back, or he would instruct me to go back, mm-hmm. and cut it even smaller.
Quality control
was right there, I'll tell you. That was his middle name. So all those meats would be cut up, and the tenderloin, I think, is the only one that actually was cooked. Mm-hmm. Everything else was not.
It was like cured meat, yeah.
Yes. So that was all done, and then the cheeses were done at some point, I guess, on Friday, whatever needed to be cut on Friday. And the process of putting it all together occurred from early in the morning on Friday through, mm-hmm. the end of that day and into evening. Mm-hmm. And
which was an excruciating process.
Yes.
Because you could not eat any of it.
Yes, because this was all taking place on Good Friday. And as good Catholics, we could not impart of the meats.
Delicious, any of the delicious meats.
And and when everything was put together, the smells and aromas were just amazing in terms of how good everything smelled. And it was always such a treat to be there in the house when all of that was being made. So all the meats would be combined. Then the eggs would be added. The boiled eggs would be added. The cheeses into as large a container as you can imagine.
Yeah. Something you'd cook a turkey in.
Yes. That's what we used. Exactly. In a couple of years, we had so much of the ingredients that we had to do it in two separate containers.
Yeah.
And so then there was this whole process of melding everything together and mixing. And finally, we'd be ready to actually put this wonderful mixture into the pies. And years ago, my aunts and other relatives, I guess my grandmother, would make their own pie shells. But my mom, who was working, leaned on the frozen pie shells. And that was what I have learned to use.
Yeah. It's just easier.
It's easier.
When you're making 20 pies.
Yeah. Well, one year we ended up making 20 pies.
Yeah. It's a lot of pie dough.
So I would fill the bottom of the pie and then take another pie crust and put it on the top and then, you know, lattice it perhaps or just pierce it and, of course, tuck it around the side as you would a regular pie. And you'd fill it, obviously, before you put the top on, you'd fill it so that it was a fairly size.
Yeah, I always remember that it was overfilled. Like, usually with pies, you fill it to just under the line of, like, the top of, but you'd always mound it so that the pie shell that went on top sort of, like,
created a crown.
Like a dome. So it was when you cut into it, it was like 3 or 4 inches thick.
Yeah.
Big pie.
And then sometimes we would take an egg yolk and do an egg wash on the top.
Yeah.
And they never took that long to bake. 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
At 350 degrees.
Yeah.
Was fine.
Yeah. Well, most of it's already cooked. So
yes. And there were years when I was able to put 8 pies in at a time because I could fit 4 on the top shelf and 4 on the bottom.
Did we at one point live somewhere where we had 2 ovens?
Yes.
A double oven? Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Steam pies. Yeah. Well, that's probably the only reason you ever said, let's make 20 pies.
Well, I think what happened was we kind of began to guesstimate to a certain extent how much we were going to need so that if I thought I was going to need, say, 2 pounds of the Parmesan, the Romano cheese, and I couldn't get quite that amount, maybe it was more, then all of a sudden everything became more.
Yeah.
So suddenly there were more pies.
Yeah.
So, but I have to say that over the years, we were always able to share some with the family and you and your brothers took some to friends of yours, and we always laugh, and I think you'll remember this. Yeah. There was a hierarchy in terms of how much pie you
got. Yeah. Well, I remember, like, usually it must have been either the week before Easter or a few days before we started actually making the pies, before you went out and, like, did the shopping for everything, you would make the list that was like, okay, well, Nan and Pop get a whole pie. And Uncle Sam and Aunt Shirley get a whole pie. And, you know, then down the list, all the different people who would get a whole pie. And then we'd get into, like, oh, well, well, this person gets a half a pie, and this person gets a half a pie, and, oh, we can give your CCD teacher a quarter of a pie, you know, like, it was just sort of like, this person, we're going to give them one to be kind, but it was sort of like this, but I like that, and I think that for me, now that I'm older, the process of making those pies instilled in me this understanding of, like, when you wanted to show somebody that you cared about them, you make them something with your hands. Mm-hmm. And so now I think very much about, like, who's on my list? Mm-hmm. Who is on my list of people who I make things for and who doesn't make the list? Because it's just, it's, you know, I only have two hands and I have two children and, you know, what do I have time to do? Mm-hmm. And I think that making the pies was, like, the beginning of that mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to make everyone that I care about a Christmas present who's on my list. Mm-hmm. And I think that, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. making the pies taught me the importance of good list making and, like, the hierarchy of, like, this person's going to get, you know, a hat. This person will get a washcloth. You know, like, what do I have time to make?
Well, I had a nice experience with someone who I worked with at the hospital mm-hmm. a few years back. And I had made the pies and or I was talking about the fact that I was making the pies. And this woman, Kathy, said, oh, she said, my mother used to love these mm-hmm. pies. She yeah. was Polish extraction. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, her mother must have known someone who was Italian.
Sure.
Of Italian descent and had given her a piece of pizza game. And Kathy remembered how much she enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Well, I was able to give her a quarter mm-hmm. of my pie.
Yeah.
That one year, and when I brought it into her, you'd think that I was giving her a gold bullion.
Yeah.
She was just so thrilled to have this piece of pizza gain, and she had tears in her eyes.
Yeah.
And she commented to me when she saw me the next day, she said, I took a bite, and it reminded me so much of my mother mm-hmm. and how much she enjoyed pizza gain.
I mean, I think food does that. We link it so heavily with emotions mm-hmm. and with mm-hmm. times that, you know, we've shared with other people or mm-hmm. that we've had on our own or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think that, I mean, that makes complete sense to me. I feel like there are things that I eat that just are overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And pizza game is definitely one of those things. This is something that's come up a few times when I've talked to people, that this idea of, like, here's a person who, you know, like, you could only spare a quarter of a pie for, you know, because, you know, they're not blood and they're not, you know, like they haven't put in their time to, like, really deserve more. And but you gave her this quarter of a pie and she loved it so much. Mm-hmm. And now when you think about making pizza game, because she received it so well, you mm-hmm. think about her. And mm-hmm. I think that, like, for me, there are people that I've made things for who they receive it and they go, oh, this is so lovely. And, like, they have a nice response to it. And then there are other people who are like, wow. Mm-hmm. I can't believe this. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And then I make them more things.
Yes.
Because you want to share things with people mm-hmm. who really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's,
sure.
you know, there's something for both people to get of from course. The process of making something.
Of course.
Which is nice.
Of course. That sort of thing also has happened to me with the eggplant mm-hmm. parmesan that I make.
Yeah.
I think I'm the only person I know who makes it as I do.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone else make it that
because
way.
Because I don't put mozzarella cheese in it or on the top. Mm-hmm. I can think back to several years before Dad and I got married, and I was friendly with a couple who you remember, mm-hmm. Dave and Linda Reich.
Yeah.
And I would frequently have dinner with them. Mm-hmm. They lived not far from where I was, and I would make eggplant parmesan sometimes and bring it up to them, and then mm-hmm. we'd reheat it. Well, the look on Dave's face mm-hmm. every time he ate my eggplant parmesan, it just filled my heart with such warmth.
Yeah.
It really did, because I to this day, mm-hmm. when I make eggplant parmesan, I think of Dave.
Yeah.
And I haven't spoken with him in quite some time, mm-hmm. but every time I make it, I think of him and how much he looked forward to it when I brought it to their house, because I would say, oh, I'm going to make eggplant parmesan. And he'd say, oh yeah, please bring it.
Yeah. Yeah. On Sunday mornings when I make pancakes for the kids, mm-hmm. I make it almost every week, but it's as if they haven't eaten it in years. They're so pancakes. And Joey eats, he's a little tiny person. He eats six pancakes every Sunday. Like he eats more pancakes than I do. And I think that that is what makes me keep making them. Sure. I wouldn't make them if somebody didn't enjoy them. But mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I have mm-hmm. this like positive feedback constantly, I'm like, oh yes, I will make more pancakes.
Yeah. So, yeah. There's a lot to be said for that. Mm-hmm. Sure.
What's the most powerful memory you have tied to something that you've created for someone?
I think I can look at myself as a middleman.
Okay.
And I'll explain this. When I was a little girl, there was a book, a storybook, called Jingle Bell Jack.
Yeah.
Jingle Bell Jack. And it was this wonderful picture book about a little girl and her mother and a craft project that they did together. Mm-hmm. And they created through using different types of fabrics that they made into, I guess you'd call yo-yos. Doilies.
Oh, yeah.
Yo-yos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They created this wonderful little puppet called Jingle Bell Jack. Mm-hmm. And he had, obviously, bells on the ends of his hands and his feet. Mm-hmm. And he had this great little face and a...
floppy hat.
A floppy hat. Mm-hmm. And I remember how reading that book and working with my mom on trying to create this was so wonderful an experience for me that you and I attempted to make one.
Yes.
Attempted.
Yeah, I don't remember being successful with it.
Well, I was not the craft maven that you have become.
Yes, I certainly wasn't a craft maven when I was very young. That's for sure. I would have been useless.
But I think that, you know, that attempt on my part to connect you, if you will, mm-hmm. to your grandmother was a way for me to feel that I was in between the two of you in the experience of life. And I think that you told me that you had tried to make it or were expecting to make it with mm-hmm. Emma.
Yes. We'll certainly make things mm-hmm. That are similar to that. Mm-hmm. And you had made me the yo-yo blanket.
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah.
I was going to bring that up. And there's a funny story associated with that in that Nanu had started making one maybe in the 1940s or early 50s.
Okay. So when you were like just born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was born in 1950 and she may have started it when my brothers were young. And it's a little time consuming.
Yeah.
It's a little labor mm-hmm. intensive to cut these
little circles.
Circles and then sew them as they need to be sewn. And so she had this cluster of all of these yo-yos that she had intended to make into a spread.
Yeah.
Because those were probably the thing to make in home decor.
In the 40s, 50s, nice.
and for whatever reason, that whole thing came to a grinding halt.
Yeah. Well, she's a young mom.
She's a young mom.
And many things come to a grinding halt.
So I think at some point or another, as I got older, then I must have discovered all of these mm-hmm. things up in the attic.
Oh, okay.
And I was able to take them with me mm-hmm. to my home. Mm-hmm. And then I guess when you had started college, I thought to myself, this would be something neat for me to try to put together and complete for Jen. Some of what ended up in that.
Really?
Spread. And I remember, I think I was working with you. You would come home.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You would come home from, maybe was during college.
Maybe during college,
And there we were in the living room spreading these things all out.
Yeah, I've been cutting them. I remember cutting a lot of those things.
And then somehow stitching them all together.
I think you hired, what's her name to do it? Danielle Romansky's mom? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, Audrey.
Yeah.
Audrey Romansky's mother.
I think you had done most of them, but she finished it or something.
She finished it, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to have made it a little bigger
than it is. It's one of the few crafts that's easy to make bigger.
Well, that's true.
Which
that's
is nice.
True.
Just yeah. add on to the
you just add on to them. Yeah. yeah. And I don't know if I had any kind of pattern in mind. I'd have to take a look at it again.
I don't know.
I haven't seen it in so long.
But yeah, it's upstairs in Emma's closet, yeah, I think. But we that sat on her, on the chair that I, you know, rocked her in for, like, until she was maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
And then she started climbing on it, and some of the pieces started getting, yes. you know, ripped apart. And I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Take
sure.
it out when.
Sure.
Yeah, but that's interesting. If there are pieces that it's almost like, you know, I shudder at the thought, but it's almost like friendship bread.
Oh, gee.
You know, like, because there's some pieces that Nano had made, and then there are the pieces that you and I made. Yeah. And then I can make it bigger with Emma, mm-hmm. and have her make some pieces and put it in, and then I could split the blanket in half and give her half of it, and I could mm-hmm. keep some, and then she could, like, it could sure. be a family mm-hmm. heirloom that sure. that gets bigger and gets cut, and because mm-hmm. it's not one of those things that, one of the few things that you can make that you can cut apart very easily and yeah. stitch mm-hmm. together with other things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I could, yeah, we could do that. That'd
yeah.
be nice.
Yeah, it turns out to be a very dynamic
mm-hmm.
thing.
Yeah.
It kind of has a life of its own.
Yeah.
Don't want to use a hackneyed expression like yeah. that, but it yeah. truly
yeah.
has a life
yeah.
that has come out of
mm-hmm.
the lives of
yeah,
several
the people.
People
who made it. Yeah. All right. So is there something that you don't currently know how to make that you would like to learn how to make?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I didn't know that I wanted to create until recently.
Okay.
And I did mention this to you a few months back.
Mm-hmm.
Words have ruled my life,
mm-hmm.
much as they have yours.
Yeah.
And that goes back to when I was 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a writer and an editor and a writer and an editor and an editor and an editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've always loved words. I've always spent a good time, a good deal of my life reading.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until the spring that I embarked upon the creation of my memoirs.
Mm.
And it was by sheer happenstance that I happened to see an article in the newspaper down in Delaware, where we're living now, that promoted this particular 5-week program.
Yeah.
I went to this class and I was just, I just felt like a whole world had been opened to me.
That's great.
Because I realized that there were so many things that had happened to me, things mm-hmm. that I had not thought about in decades,
yeah,
and things that were really seminal in terms of who I was to become.
Sure.
And in that 5-week period, if I said it already, I'll repeat it. It was as if a whole new world opened
yeah.
to me.
Gives you new perspective on
yes.
old stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I finished that program and was very energized by the response of the instructor to a number of things that I had written. So I have continued since then,
mm-hmm.
and there are many more memoirs to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the middle of his advanced program right now,
mm-hmm.
and I'll finish that up in about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I've enjoyed most about it is been peeling things away
mm-hmm.
and seeing with refreshed eyes, if you mm-hmm. will.
Sure.
Things that happened to me or people who were important to me
mm-hmm.
or events that were things that I, in a sense, kind of took in stride and mm-hmm. yet realize now that they were pretty compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And the instructor said to me, and he hasn't really completely explained this to me, but he has said, you avoid many of the pitfalls that other memoir writers fall into.
Oh, okay.
And I haven't been able to extract from him exactly what he means by that. So yeah, all I know is that I must be doing something good.
Yeah. I wonder if he's being obtuse because if he lets you know what those pitfalls are, that you might start to inadvertently do them.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's exactly. Possible. Exactly. Some people, when they write memoirs of any kind, it's really just for their own, you know, like, well, this is just for me and I'm just writing it for me and I'm the only audience that I'll ever have and that kind of thing. Are you thinking that that's what you want to do, or is this something that you're like, I want to share this with other people? I want to.
Well, I'd love to share it with other people. I don't know exactly how I'm going to do that because I think that there's still much more that has to be written.
Oh, yeah.
Again, not to sound hackneyed, but I just feel like I've started to just scrape the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot that I feel I could probably expand upon.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the interesting thing about this particular class has been that the instructor has asked us to keep the memoir to a 150-word limit.
Oh, okay. So they're like short essays.
They're very short essays. Hmm. But over the course of the summer, in several instances, I expanded some of them.
That's
good.
But
to write 150 words to convey a memory is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
But I have to say that there were some of the public relations assignments I had when I was in healthcare, I needed to write something in 199 words.
Mm-hmm.
So I was used to that kind of brevity and having to get to the kernel of something in as few words as possible.
Okay.
That's kind of a challenge to convey what I want to convey and also use the words I want to use. Because you could simply be very matter of fact.
Yeah, of course.
About.
But if you want to be eloquent and poetic, then you need to pick and choose carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
So the plan is that I'll finish up this class in the next couple of weeks and then hopefully continue.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been very supportive and encouraging and has said, anytime you want to send anything along to me, I'll be happy to read
That's great. Good.
And he's explained, well, you know, you could publish it on your own and go to Staples. Or he said, you know, you could go to a publisher or...
Yeah. There are a lot of small publishing companies now that, you know...
Exactly.
...do things like that. Like with this project that I'm working on, I mean, the majority of people who will listen to it are people who know me and who know the people who are... on the episodes, but I'm self-publishing it, you know, like I have a server that a friend of mine lets me host the episodes on, and it's the world of podcasting it's got a very low bar to entry. You know, I can just put it on the internet and people can listen to it, very straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think books are a little bit harder, but it's become easier now. You can self-publish through an actual publishing company.
Yes.
You have to pay them some money.
Yes.
But then you put it up on Amazon and you can send a link to it to all of your friends and they'll publish an actual book and send it to those people. So it's a thing that is possible now that used to not be possible. And maybe the only people who ever read it are people who know you and know our family. And, you know, but I think that's fine. I think that there are so many stories that if they're not written down, they just float away on the breeze. Like there's no way to capture them because a lot of people choose not to share certain stories for whatever reason, either because they don't think the story is interesting or because they're embarrassed about it or they're concerned about whatever reason you would have to not share something. And so there are lots of stories that, you know, you just never know. Your great grandparents, I know nothing about. I don't know their names. I don't know how old they lived to be. I know nothing about them. Could I find that out? Sure. I'm sure I could do some research and figure it out. But I mean, that's how short-lived some of those stories
are. Of course.
So creating something that has some physical element to it gives it a little bit more staying power, I think.
Sure.
So,
Well, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
As I said, there's a lot more work that has to be done. But I think what I've written so far is good stuff. I'm proud of what I've written so far. And the thing that is important to me is that if a stranger can pick it up, if it resonates with that person, mm-hmm. then it's meaningful to me.
Yeah.
Okay. It's meaningful if members of my family, my brother, my cousins enjoy it, or close mm-hmm. friends of mine enjoy it. But if someone were to see it online or in a bookstore and who did not know me from Adam mm-hmm. and it meant something to that person, mm-hmm. then that yeah. would be such a wonderful thing for me.
Yeah. If you can create something that has that universal quality where mm-hmm. someone who has lived a drastically different life than you have mm-hmm. can still pick it up and find meaning and value and mm-hmm. some kinship in it, then,
yes.
you know, then you've done your job. Mm-hmm. You've created the thing that you needed to make. And
yeah. Exactly.
Those are good reads
mm-hmm.
when you
mm-hmm.
happen upon those.
Yep.
So is there anything else you'd like to say about the process of creating things?
Creation should happen naturally, mm-hmm. in a sense. It should be something that was meant to be. It should be something that's obviously meaningful to the creator and something that adds a dimension to whoever may touch it or read it or see it or mm-hmm. feel it or taste it. And that's what makes it a good creation. And that's what makes the creator a very powerful individual.
Capturing these stories from my mom was so special for me. Even with traditions and stories as fundamental to my childhood as these, it's lovely to discover new details and even better to capture them for the future. I haven't made pizzagin in many years, but this conversation with my mom has inspired me to continue the tradition with my kids, starting next week. I don't know if I'll ever be brave enough to make 20 pies, but then again, I'm sure my mom had the same thought once upon a time. And now, I'd like to tell you about something I made this week. I made a sizable addition to my knitting stash. This past weekend was the Knit North Yarn Crawl that had 9 participating shops north of Boston. Each shop had special promotions and sales for the 4-day event. So one morning, I hopped in the car with my son and we drove to all 9 stores. The big find of the day was 12 skeins of yarn I bought to finally knit my family's Christmas stockings. Joey was a hit in each shop and had so much fun meeting all of the other crawlers, most of whom were grandmothers who were happy to have a toddler around to fawn over. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Special thanks to my mom, Kathy Salamon, for helping me to celebrate my heritage each springtime and for keeping our family traditions alive. Our music is by Chuck Salamon. Our logo is by Becky Carpenter. We get system admin support from Greg Thole. Now, go make something for someone you love.